This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined by Bradley Chambers, as always. And we are without a sponsor this week, but if you'd like to sponsor the show, you can get in touch through our website, outofschool.net. Good morning, Bradley. How are you?
I am fantastic. I am drinking coffee. It's 6 a.m., so I am ready to go.
You're all set for the morning. You're a morning person.
Yeah, well, we're actually on spring break as well. And then the funny thing is, it's been snowing off and on here this week. And so the fact that it's spring break and snowing just seems, it's all, I guess that's Al Gore's problem.
It's an unusual combination.
Yeah.
Cool. So, any news? We were just mentioned before we came on here that Evernote have got a nice update on the server side.
Yeah, you can now, like if you're a premium member and you've got Word docs or really any Office docs and then iWork docs, it'll do server-side search when you search in the apps. Again, that's only for a premium member. But I do like that method of how, you know, all the new features are coming to the premium. It's, you know, let the basic server stay the same way it is and then let people be motivated to upgrade.
Yeah, and I think in a world in which things that are free are going away with quite some regularity, then it's comforting to pay for something, particularly with a company like Evernote who have stated they want to be around for 100 years. Now, whether they make it to 100 or not, I don't know, but it gives me a certain sense of confidence to pay for things these days, even though some things that have been paid are still going away as well. You know, it's no guarantee of anything, but it certainly helps.
Well, and I think we've all kind of learned a hard lesson with Google Reader. We were all so invested in that, and really it's going away. And when they release a service like Google Keep, you think, what's my motivation to get, you know, kind of hone into that? I mean, if Evernote was shutting down next week, I would have some serious, A, workflow issues, but B, like, I got to get this stuff out. And while they have, you know, a good export feature, I don't know where I would put all of that stuff, I guess in Dropbox. And so, you know, it just, again, it makes me, especially a service like this, it makes me kind of want to, I don't know, be bought into it. I want to pay for it. I want to be basically almost like a partner of theirs. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it was a bit of a shame that Google Keep was the first thing that came out after Reader was killed, because it didn't, I think a lot of people have had their confidence a little knocked in Google's free services.
Well, it just, I guess it goes back ultimately to what's your business model. And it would be the same thing if Apple, let's say, came out with some sort of hosted service that you know wasn't really meant for schools, but you kind of wanted to shoehorn it into using it in your school. I mean, what's your confidence that Apple's going to keep that around? Because ultimately, if it doesn't help them sell more iPads and iPhones and iPods, it's not in their plans. And so, again, that's what makes me kind of love Evernote, because my data is their business.
Absolutely. And I think it's been interesting to me over the past few months that more and more, as I've been talking about what kind of computers to use in schools and how to deploy them, the conversation always kind of ends up at the point where I'm talking about the business model of the company that we're dealing with. And often that comes out in the comparison between whether you should go for an Android device or you should go for a Microsoft device or an Amazon Kindle Fire, for example. And we quite often have the conversation about, well, what's Apple's business model? They want to sell you an iPad every 3 years. End of story. That's basically how Apple makes their money, and we know that. Amazon are very explicit in their business model as well, which is that they want to sell you a device at basically cost price or less, and then make their money by having you buy things through that device. And then Google's business model, as we know, is basically free services that are supported and monetized through advertising. And the question really always comes down to, well, which one of these can you live with? And sometimes people will happily trade off their data privacy in return for low cost or free services. And that's a fine decision to make, as long as you make it in an informed fashion. Whereas other people maybe want more of an ownership experience rather than what is almost starting to feel like a kind of rental experience through some other services, and then maybe they'll go iOS. So I think we can't be naive about these things. I think more and more this information is known. It's not hidden. It's basically obvious to people who take the time to look at how these businesses operate and where they make their money. And that's got to be part of your strategy too. It absolutely does, particularly in a world where strategies are changing so rapidly as this mobile market starts settling down just a little bit, and then people are trying to disrupt it again. You've got to have a feeling for exactly what way things are going. I don't know. Do you listen to Horace Degio's podcast, The Critical Path?
I do.
I consider that to be essential listening for anybody in our business, because it gives you a lot of insight. He does a lot of analysis on Samsung and Apple and Amazon and various other companies. And that gives me a lot of insight into where these companies are going and what their strategies might be. Now, obviously, there's a bit of guesswork has to happen in there as well on my part, and a lot of assumptions and planning and second guessing sometimes. But I think that's definitely a podcast that we should recommend to people, because I think it's becoming an increasingly important part of understanding the whole planning process. Whereas it used to be you just understand the technology and you're done. Today, I think you've got to understand these business models as well.
Well, it really goes back to, because so many of our things we use in our server side now, and of course, you and I both use Google Apps for our schools. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things, they could easily kill that in another year. I like to think that they won't, because that ultimately is part of Google's core services of getting you to search for things. And because you're using Google Apps and Google Docs, that you're more likely to use their search. But, you know, long gone are the days where you can say, okay, nothing is changing in our deployment for 3 years. You know, if in 2 months, Google said, hey, we're sunsetting Google App, the free version of Google Apps for education, you either have to pay or you have to move on. You've got some changes to make in your deployment model, either with your budget or your email server.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't even have to be as dramatic as that. Because what would it be if you just said, well, we're turning off IMAP? You know, the server still exists. We're not killing your accounts or anything, but we're just turning off IMAP. And you have to do everything through the web. And how does that work for me in a world where I'm using iPad and then they want to put it all onto the web interface, which is not, shall we say, the nicest of them all. So,
yeah, especially on iOS, I really just don't believe that web apps are a future. I mean, not that they're not a future, but I don't think they can be a core part of your deployment. This the experience isn't there.
No, it's not. Not yet. I mean, I've always said that it's not going to happen, but I'm sure it's not here today. And I think there's evidence for that from companies like Facebook, for example, who rolled back on their HTML5 strategy and went back towards native applications. And there's recently some news about another company whose name I forget, but they're some kind of accounting company where they had an HTML version of their software. And then they've said, well, actually, it's easier just to build native apps and to get HTML5 working well across all these different devices. The day could come, though. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't think it's guaranteed forever, but particularly on mobile devices, if you look at the Google Docs experience on a mobile device, for example, through the browser, it's really, really, really not good enough at all. It's only barely good enough on the desktop, in my opinion, but I'm biased.
It's funny that you say that. I don't know how it is over where you're at, but like when our schools go through our accreditation for our, you know, one of the ones we are big on are SAIS accreditation, Southern Association of Independent Schools. Mm-hmm. And so the other headmasters kind of go visit the other schools. And so you have an accreditation committee. So my headmaster will do those throughout the year. And ours is actually coming up in the fall. So he was just recently on an accreditation visit in North Carolina. Well, he was wanting to do all their kind of notes over Google Docs. I got an email. Hey, one of the ladies has an iPad and it's not working very well. What does she need to do? Basically just responded with download the app. And so that's a perfect example of, you know, Google Docs is primarily a web-based service, but you go to iOS and just get the app. Don't worry about the, you know, it's just not meant to be, you know, again, make a quick edit here and there, but it's just not meant to use, I guess, long form.
Yeah, definitely agree. Okay. So our big topic for today, Bradley, is mainly in your hands. You've been working on your Mac redeployment. You were mentioned the other week that you had a cupboards full of boxes of stuff from Apple. Tell us how it's going.
Well, it's going well so far. Again, this is primarily, you know, a lot of the stuff will not be deployed over the summer. And that could be a topic for a future show, is kind of what we do in the summer, because I get asked that from teachers a lot. Like, what do you do all summer long? And there is quite a bit. It's just a lot of behind the scenes stuff. So I just want to walk through kind of my process on migrating teachers to their new computers, kind of some of our back-end systems, if you haven't listened to one of the previous shows. And I apologize if we have any extra background noise this week. I'm actually at home, and so if my son wakes up or whatnot. So our lease included 35 MacBook Airs, 13-inch. It was the stock model with 4 gigabytes of RAM. Our student computers are 11-inch MacBook Airs, and then we added 45 iPads. So that brings us to around 80 iPads total in production. And then we have 10 iMacs already in our library that are there. So it kind of gives you a background on our setup. So, you know, we're working through the notes here. Why didn't we do 1-to-1? I really don't think I'd want to do a 1-to-1 on Mac ever. I think when we move to that, it'll be on iPad. And we're just waiting on a couple pieces, especially on the teacher's side, to do that. Mainly, significantly upgraded student information system app. Our provider, RenWeb, just had a big new update to their app, but I still don't feel like it could be used full-time. It's, again, more of an adjunct add-on to the web interface. So, and then we're still waiting for this book thing to be worked out. Our parents really want us to solve electronic books, and we've just not been able to do that yet. We've been working with companies, working with our publishers. We just can't get them, which is very frustrating.
Yeah, that's going to take some time. Quite a lot of time, possibly.
Yeah, probably. I may be retired.
Maybe forever.
Yeah, maybe never.
Yeah. So you're in carts for the kids, is that right?
Carts for the kids, and so we'll stay there at least for the next couple of years. And again, yeah.
Is that a kind of Brentford cart or something, powered charging carts?
It is. Yeah. And we didn't buy a new one. We used the same one as we had before, because ultimately those things are really just a cart with a big surge protector inside of them, and they're really expensive. And so we just used the one we had.
So one question with that, obviously the new laptops are going to have the MagSafe 2 connector, is that right? So you're going to, does the cart have built-in cabling, or do you just plug in the adapters that come in the box?
You just plug in the adapters. It's got, above the slots, it's got just an AC plug, which is great.
Well, that certainly extends the life of those things, because I recently saw some charging carts where they had sort of built in 30-pin dock connectors to them, and that was all a bit awkward when people were showing up at the conference we were at with iPad minis and iPhone 5s.
Well, I had forgotten that the new computers would come with MagSafe 2, and I'll mention that later, that had basically mentioned that to our teachers towards the beginning of the refresh, that hey, if you want to use your old cord, you know, you need this little adapter. So I'd forgotten about MagSafe 2. So next up on the list is our directory system. We do not use one. Basically, our teachers share all their files over Google Docs/Drive, and then on our student computers, we have a upgraded Dropbox account. So again, it seems kind of hokey, but it really works well for us. It's really simple, and so all the student computers just have a generic login. That's the name of it's BBS Student, for Brainerd Baptist School Student. We have a generic passcode. Then the teachers have their own login to their computer. That's an administrator account, and then I have an administrator account on their computer as well, if I need to log in via Apple Remote Desktop.
Okay, so teachers will basically be using they will have a 1-to-1 with their own laptop. Is that right?
Correct.
And then the kids will log into some generic account, and their workflow looks like Dropbox, basically.
Exactly. Yeah, it's Microsoft Office based with Dropbox, and then a few of our grades now have access to their own Google Apps account.
Okay. So how do you handle that when you're logging into one user account on the Mac and people are trying to go to separate Dropboxes?
No, it's the same. There's like one big generic Dropbox account.
Yeah,
we kind of treat it as a file server, and it really, we've done that for 2 years now, and it really works well, particularly with the LAN syncing. And you know, we've got a pretty fast internal network, and again, really fast external network. You and I were talking about that on Twitter, that we've not had an ISP outage in really 2 or 3 years. I know you wouldn't.
We've had a few more than that.
You've had one today.
Yeah, indeed.
Distribution of software. We do everything either manually or via Apple Remote Desktop. Most of it's done ahead of time. We use very little desktop software other than what actually came with the computer with iLife, and then we install Microsoft Office. Our student information system is web-based. It's RenWeb. Now, we don't, the web interface is somewhat still limited compared to their actual Windows PC desktop program. I have to run VMware during the day to manage that system, but that's quickly coming to an end. They've got a beta of their new fully functional website that I was supposed to be on the beta, but I haven't yet. receive access. So hoping that I'll be able to ditch VMware soon and get about 50 gigs back on my computer. Yeah, that'll be nice, especially on a flash memory computer. So then email and calendar are, again, our web base. We are a Google Apps School, and we really stick to the web interface. There are, you know, there are aspects of using, you know, Apple Mail that I would prefer, but we use Google Drive / Docs a lot in our workflows, and so it's just kind of, you're already there. It kind of works. What's the approach to the Mac App Store? So that's new for us this year, that our last computers had Snow Leopard. These computers now have the Mac App Store. So if a teacher has an update to iPhoto, he or she will have to sign in to an Apple ID. So what do we do there? So basically, I have told our teachers, hey, you know, here's the situation. Most of your software updates are done through, you know, the App Store. Most of them are familiar with the App Store because they have iPhones. I would venture to say that 98% of our faculty now carries an iPhone. Mm-hmm. And the one that doesn't, one or two that don't, have Android phones. So they're still kind of used to the idea of an App Store. So I just basically told them, hey, we don't have a way to create everybody their own Apple accounts, nor do we really need that at this time. So if you want to purchase any applications or download any free ones, you just need to sign in with your Apple ID. And I told them, hey, you can use your work email, but just know that it's a separate system and something that I, you know, cannot manage. On our student computers, again, we obviously aren't one-to-one, so they can't use their own accounts. I have a generic Apple ID that I use. It's I believe it's ios@brainerdbaptist.org. Don't ask me why I use iOS on the Mac. I use that on a lot of things. So, and then I go in periodically via Apple Remote Desktop and update those machines. You know, we have the software update turned off by default.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's the Mac App Store really kind of threw a wrench into it for a lot of schools, because again, it's mm-hmm. something else that, you know, before you could say, okay, don't sign in to a MobileMe account, but there's really no way to not have an Apple ID if you want to get updates to iLife, because they come preloaded on the machine, and you know when you go into software update, it lets you do all the system updates without a Apple ID. But if you want to update into the iLife suite, then you've got to basically, you know, sign into an account. One of the things that was interesting is that the amount of teachers that had found the Mac App Store in Snow Leopard and had proceeded to download a few applications. So I saw a lot of teachers had that. So it gave me great hope that they'd be able to figure out the, you know, sign in method, because they obviously had before.
Yeah. I mean, the Mac App Store is pretty straightforward. I mean, I think, in the early days of the Mac App Store, people were more nervous than they are today, I think, because we weren't sure whether the strategy was everything through the Mac App Store and nothing else. I mean, when 10.8 came out, one of the questions was, will it be, you know, Mac App Store installed apps only and nothing else? But now that we have this gatekeeper system, it's clear that we can still install things other ways as well. And it seems to be a reasonable compromise. I mean, iOS has obviously gone completely the other way, and it's App Store or nothing there, and we've figured out how to live with that. But I mean, for the most part, the way we figured out how to live with that is to go one-to-one.
I agree. Where it's, yeah, you know, you have your own account and you use it day-to-day just like you would use your iPhone.
Yeah, I mean, that's where we're going after the summer with our senior kids, is completely individual model accounts on their iPad. And it should bring a nice degree of flexibility, but still for younger kids, we'll have to figure out some other way of doing that kind of thing.
That's actually a good point. One of the things I failed to mention earlier is what our strategy is for Gatekeeper. And the setting that I'm making the default is that it's App Store and signed applications only.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, it looks like Office was signed. One of our other applications that some of our teachers use, was not. So I had to do the control click to get that going. But that seems like a really nice compromise. So if a teacher goes to download Skype or something like that, more than likely he or she will be able to install that with no problems. And again, we're a small enough school where if I have to go help a few teachers, you know, install something manually, it's not a big deal at all.
Yeah.
That's one of the things where, you know, one of the things I talk about often is I make decisions and take advantage of the fact that we are a small school. We have 300 kids. I'm not managing, you know, 75 teachers in a school of, you know, 1,300 kids. I don't have to act like I'm a huge school. I can be flexible.
Yeah, you can sometimes brute force problems that other people would need to have completely automated.
Exactly. And so, you know, you can, you know, get rid of servers and systems and things, because, you know, I could spend a day doing something once a year.
Yeah, definitely.
So let's talk about the kind of the process I used to do this. Now, this is different from last time, because last time was our first kind of go around with the Mac. So we were moving everybody from PC desktops onto the Mac. So it's a completely different process this time. So we start with the administration staff. So I migrated my computer, my headmaster, my assistant headmaster, and our academic counselor. Got them to their new computers first. So the process we use are, I email them the day before. I'm going to be kind of migrating them. I usually do two at a time. So I say, hey, go ahead and use your backup drive. Again, we give each teacher a Time Machine drive when we give them their computers. And of course, as a side note, I mentioned teachers as females most of the time. It's because we have one male faculty outside of the headmaster and myself. Our PE teacher is male, so I'm used to just working with females. So it's not read nothing behind that. just my experiences at our school. So email them the night before and say, hey, I'm going to be migrating you tomorrow to your new computer. Can you use your backup drive and make kind of one final backup for me? And then when I come in and pick it up the next morning, I just remind them, hey, if you do any work on any local applications like Office, you'll need to kind of remember those files so we can move those manually later. But then I remind them, hey, don't worry, your email and all your Google stuff is coming right over. So I take the computer out of the box, boot it up, go straight to the migration assistant in the setup. One of the things I have found interesting in the migration assistant is it asks you to connect to Wi-Fi before it does the migration, which I find interesting, because if you didn't connect and you just went to the migration process, it should then still remember to connect to a network, because it would remember it from the previous computer. So I'm wondering what the reason Apple decided to ask for that was. I don't know. Maybe there's something in the migration assistant that likes to be able to phone home.
Well, I know in migration assistant you can technically migrate over Wi-Fi, although it will take about 100 years to finish. But I do understand that that's possible. So
that's right.
Maybe that's why they're trying to fire up the Wi-Fi.
That's right. You know, one of the things I was thinking about is, of course, I'm using their backup drives, because, you know, I've never had great experience doing computer to computer over Wi-Fi. I've tried it once; it was terrible. So the Time Machine drives are really easy, because it's just straight USB. So our next go around, if we still had Macs and didn't have iPads, I could get a Thunderbolt cable, and that would be really fast.
Yeah.
So once I do that, it usually takes about 30 minutes to migrate all of their data. I have the teacher actually log in to their account for me. So I usually will take the computer to them, say, hey, just log in for me real quick. I don't know their passwords, really don't want to know them. Most of them will just tell me, but I really like to not know teachers' passcodes. I then log in and rename the computer from the network perspective. So I'll call it, you know, Jim Bob's MacBook Air instead of Jim Bob's MacBook, which is what it would be before. This helps me on Apple Remote Desktop to be able to know which computer is which. Our next process is go in there and remove Office 2008. It has a built-in uninstaller, but the best I can tell, all it's doing is moving it to the trash.
Okay.
So after that, we install Office 2011. Microsoft does a pretty nice job on the Mac. Is that, you know, they give you basically one DMG file that kind of has your license hard coded in it. There's no serial number to put in. Just install it.
Microsoft are really good at that.
Yeah. Again, that goes back to that's like their core competency.
Well, I keep saying to people that Microsoft really know how to look after their customers. It's just that their customers are the IT guys, not the users of the computer.
That's a good point. So one of the things that's kind of frustrating about this Office process is all of the teachers love to have Office on their dock. So they have Word, PowerPoint, and Excel on their dock. When you remove Office 2008, it doesn't remove those icons. So then you have to manually remove them, which again doesn't sound like a lot, but A, you have to do that 35 times, and B, on Mountain Lion, you have to move the icons a little further up the screen to get them to be removed. Now, I love that feature, because we had a situation, you know, multiple times where teachers thought they had deleted applications because that actually dragged them off of their dock, because it was much easier on Snow Leopard to do that. So, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that remains a confusing thing to a lot of people, the relationship between the dock and the existing app. I've got people who have never kind of got over that, you know, if it's not in the dock, it doesn't exist. And I think perhaps the confusion may even be greater now with iOS, because in iOS, if you delete an application from your dock on iOS, that is the application deleted, whereas on the Mac, it's not. So as people kind of come to the Mac from iOS, their expectations will be different again. I suppose Launchpad is kind of a beginning way to unify those two ideas, but the dock still remains a different thing.
Well, I think John Gruber mentioned maybe last year that he kind of thought that one of the things the Mac might eventually do is ditch the application folder and ditch kind of the desktop as we know it as a place to store files and simply make that Launchpad.
Well, I can see that happening, absolutely. I mean, when I moved to my new MacBook Air, I usually use Launchbar to launch things. And I spent the first sort of 3 months just using Launchpad instead, the built-in thing. And because it now has type-ahead selection, it's actually a pretty decent replacement for Launchbar, at least being used in its basic form. Now, there's obviously a lot more you can do with Launchbar or Quicksilver or whatever you use, but I find it remarkably okay. You know, it was pretty competent.
Did you see the news about Quicksilver last night?
No, I did not.
It has come out of beta after 10 years.
Really?
Yeah. A friend of the show, Stephen Hackett, he had the best URL for his story on it. I tweeted about it, and I'll put a link in the show notes. The URL slug was more like slow silver. Am I right? I mean, it's crazy to think that application has been around for 10 years.
Yeah.
I don't know. It makes me feel old.
Yeah. macOS 10 is getting old now. You know, it's a system that's, what was it, 2000, 2001 it first came out, and it was 2000, I think it was, the first version, 2001, the first usable version. But it's definitely been, it's been OS X's decade. But it's interesting, though, I mean, I'm totally going off topic here, but there was a time when OS X was like the hacker's OS of choice, and it still is to a certain extent. I mean, to a great extent, I think it is, because people want nice UI things as well as Unix under the hood. But in many ways, that the 10, 12 years since OS X kind of became popular, in many ways in Apple's history, those have been really very anomalous years, because Apple never before was the hacker's computer of choice. And obviously with iOS, it's not really the hacker's mobile OS of choice either. But OS X has kind of had this period in the middle where it was been a very power user operating system for a while. And it's interesting to see where that's going to go in the future.
You know, it's interesting as I've gotten a little older how I've wanted to tinker with things quite a bit less. I don't know if that's just this, me getting more used to the iOS model or me just having less free time. But I'm like a lot less likely to try new software, to change my workflow. I don't know. A couple of years ago, I would always want to try the new application, see if I can switch my task management to this or task management to that. Now I could kind of care less, and I'd rather just get work done.
Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent that part of that is because things have just gotten better. That tinkering and writing scripts and things were something you had to do to kind of tie together a lot of these very immature things that were on OS X. You know, when we were on 10.3 and 10.4 and so on, there was a lot of tweaks you wanted to do because there were a lot of things that weren't really in the operating system right now or at that point. And today, I think things have just gotten so much better. I mean, you think about the MacBook Air, for example. You know, the chances of me opening this computer up are zero. But also the chances of anything going wrong with the computer are pretty low as well. So there is a trade-off to be made there. And I think, obviously, you know, there are always people who tinker for fun, and there are people who have that kind of time on their hands. And I think it is partly a function of just getting older and having more responsibilities, having less time. And also having more critical data is another thing. I mean, we talked at the start of the show about what happens if Evernote goes away. There's a lot of really important data in Evernote, you know, and I think it's easy to kind of break up your system and move it along when, A, you don't have very much data, and B, none of it really matters very much. But if you have a lot of critical data and you've got actual work to get done every single day of your life, then I guess naturally you gravitate away from trying out new things all the time.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting to think that, you know, my first version of the Mac was Panther. And I remember, I guess it was 2004. Mm-hmm. I'd never used a Mac before. And a coworker said, hey, you know, I'm getting a Mac. You should look at it. And I really enjoyed it. So I picked up a 12-inch PowerBook. And really, that was the computer I used for a long time. My next computer after that was a 2008 unibody MacBook, and that was still a great computer as well. But man, that PowerBook was a great machine. That was the machine that I first tried out, you know, NetNewsWire, and just good memories.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, there's a nice mature tool set now on the Mac, and I think it's not... It's interesting to me how, like you said, how often I don't go to the app stores anymore. You know, I've got the tools I like, I've got the tools that really work for me, and I'm kind of happy to invest more time in making those things better rather than necessarily always looking for another thing that's different.
Well, and that goes back to our discussion on paying for things. Like, you know, I'm by paying for Evernote, I'm hoping in some ways to keep myself from having to migrate my data to something new.
Yeah.
So
anyway, we're way off topic already.
Yeah. So
we're talking about Office. Office. Yeah.
So
Office.
Then I add. It's funny when you install Office 2011 that it puts in Word, PowerPoint, and Excel on the dock, which is good. But it also puts in Microsoft Communicator, Microsoft Outlook, Microsoft Document Manager, and Microsoft Remote Desktop. And I would love to see data on who actually keeps those things on the dock. Like what person, like, you know, what percent of Office users will have ever have a need for, let's say, Remote Desktop? I just, you know, so it's just, I end up having to then remove those. I get rid of Communicator. I'm not even really sure what that is. And then I get rid of Outlook and get rid of Remote Desktop. And so really all that's on the dock is Word, PowerPoint, and Excel. So my next step is then to run all OS and Office updates. Office, at this point, we usually have one. It looks like the files that you download from Microsoft's Volume Licensing Center gets updated periodically. So you don't basically download like the original 2011 file and have to do all of the updates. It looks like they slipstream it on occasion because I only have one update to do, which is nice. It's only about 100 megabytes. And then these computers shipped with 10.2. And so I've got to get to 10.3. It's funny that 10.3 came out literally the day I was starting the refresh. So I thought that was actually good because who knows if we'll even get to 10.8.4.
Yeah.
So get all those updates, get everything kind of, I guess, fully patched. Then I also verify that Chrome, Firefox, and Flash are all on the latest versions and are set to update automatically. And I've actually been pretty impressed, especially with Flash, oddly enough, on how many teachers, when they, you know, have updated it on occasion, because again, that was something that they had to update themselves, you know, when it prompted them, actually said, hey, keep this updated automatically, because it said it was recommended. So that was actually good. And I really like that model that Flash and Firefox and Chrome are doing, where it's kind of zero touch updates. It just doesn't ask you, it just does it on relaunch.
Yeah, that's fine as long as they never screw up an update.
That is true. So Chrome, again, does a good job of that. Firefox used to not. In years past, I would periodically go check each teacher's computer via Remote Desktop and just tell Firefox to update. And again, the main reason I have all those browsers are kind of twofold. Firefox is the recommended browser for RenWeb, our student information system. And then I set all of our teachers' Chrome installations to default the homepage to be our webmail. And so I kind of tell them, hey, you can use whatever browser you want, but do your email in Chrome and do RenWeb in Firefox. And then Flash, because the reason I install that, you know, frankly, is because they'll hit something that needs it. And I would rather me install it, make sure the settings are right, than them do it and then something not work right.
Yeah, I mean, so many educational things are still crusty old things. We still have to deploy Java and also Shockwave. There's one thing left in our world where we have to use these plugins for, and we're trying to get off it, but it's not there yet. And it's interesting, I emailed them, I said, guys, it's 2013, you know, Java, really? And they emailed back and they said, well, we'd love to move forward, but 50% of our hits come from browsers which do not support HTML5. And this is a product that's designed and sold for Scottish schools. So what they were basically saying to me is that so many schools in Scotland are still on ancient browsers that they couldn't possibly drop support for these plugins and migrate towards HTML5, which was surprising to me that it was that proportion, but, you know, also not surprising at the same time.
Well, and it's kind of like that chicken or the egg. Do you, as a provider, do you wait for your customers to update their machines, or do you force them to update? Like, one of our big things we use with our students is a program called Advanced Reader. It's a web-based reading comprehension program that's kind of integrated in with our library software. And they end of life old browsers very, very frequently. I know you've got to at minimum have, like, I think, you know, Firefox at least 10, I think at least Chrome 15, Safari 3, and Internet Explorer 9 at minimum. And so they're not like trying to support Internet Explorer 6 and 7 anymore. They're saying you've got to get off those old ones, which I appreciate because it means they're trying to take advantage of new technology.
Well, I mean, at some level, it's a security issue as well. You know, having these ancient browsers lying about is not the most secure arrangement that you can be under. So I think it's surprising, but not surprising, like I said, that people are still on old browsers. But I question whether or not that's a very safe thing to do.
No, I agree. Last few steps I do as I launch iPhoto. The main reason I do this is not to look through their photos, but to make sure that the library is upgraded properly. You know, we're moving from iPhoto 09 to iPhoto 11. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just to, so they don't have to deal with that, looking at the upgrade, if they get their computer and need to grab a photo, I want them to be able to basically launch iPhoto. So it takes me just...
Yeah, because that can sometimes be quite long.
Yeah, especially...
And it's also very upsetting for people.
Yeah,
because... I mean, there's so much invested in iPhoto that whenever you see, oh, fixing your library or whatever, you know, people can be quite panicky about that.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. It takes me a couple clicks to do that, and I can then walk away, grab a cup of coffee, and come back, and it'll be done. So the very last thing I do is I grab the serial number, and then I verify that I can still connect to the computer using Apple Remote Desktop. Now, one of the things I am doing this go-around that is a change from last time is I, in the past, had stored our serial numbers in an application called Mac Tracker. It's really actually built for this because you can store what, you know, it has built in Apple models. So it can show you kind of when the computer was made, the parts, that, you know, the default build and things like that. But I really never use any of those features. And so what I've decided to do is just simply move to a number spreadsheet. So that way, if I'm on my iPad and need to look up a serial number, I have it right there with me.
That's what I've done for our iPads, actually, is just use a serial number. And I have one, basically two interlinked worksheets, one of which is the devices, and then the other one is the users who have user information in the other sheet, and then the sort of foreign key is a serial number between both sides, so who's got which device, so you know not only whose is the device but also who it's currently assigned to, because over the course of 3 years you may end up reassigning the same device to different pupils year on year. Or perhaps, you know, one device will go out of service, it'll be replaced by another one, so you'll get new serial numbers in over the course of your deployment as well.
And one of the things, obviously, that I didn't mention is we don't use asset tags. Again, that goes back to we're not big enough to need that. And you typically will have a tough time selling those machines back to Apple if they have permanent asset tags if it affixed to them.
Yeah. Now, are you using a barcode scanner of any kind to capture that information, or are you just typing in by hand?
Just typing it in. I'll use a barcode scanner probably this summer with our iPads. One of the ladies on the church staff actually has one that works perfect with it. The main reason I don't is because I'm not entering them all at one time. I'm entering them one by one. And so what I actually do is my last step, and I connect using Apple Remote Desktop, I will just run a script to pull the... serial number and just copy and paste that into the number spreadsheet. But when I do our iPads, I inventory those kind of all at once. And it's awesome because on the bulk purchasing, like there is basically the iPads come in a brown box with the power cords are all separate as well in one big box. And so the barcode's actually on the outside of that. And I can just run down through with a scanner and put it into like a number spreadsheet. And it works very well.
Yeah, I think I'm probably going to do something similar because I'm also going to want to this time capture the Wi-Fi MAC address of every device as well, because obviously now in AeroHive we can do more. If we know the MAC address of the machine, we can start to organize things a bit better that way.
I'm wondering if that MAC address is on the outside of the bulk purchasing boxes. I do not know that, because I know on the retail box.
On the retail box for sure. Yeah.
I wish I was at work and I could look that up, but I'll figure that out for next show.
We'll follow up on that.
But they do a really nice job of their packing now. I was amazed of like how much smaller our shipment was, because there is no wasted space in these boxes. It's really kind of amazing.
Well, when we got our iPads 3 years ago, they all came in retail packaging. So we had, it was not just retail packaging, but also the shipping cartons that go to the retail store. So we had a kind of protective cardboard box, and then inside that was a plain cardboard box, and inside that were spacers with 5 iPads, all in retail packaging. And it honestly took us literally 2 days just to go from a pallet of boxes to iPads in retail boxes with the shrink wrap taken off them. It was it was unbelievable amount of effort.
Yeah, people.
I don't know yet if they ship it, those multi packs in the UK or not. I know that they've sold those in the US for a while, but I still don't know if those are available in the UK.
Yeah, it'll almost work against you if they do, and it doesn't include the Wi-Fi MAC address. I never thought about tracking that. That's a good idea.
It's just something that's easy to capture at one time, and then it's hard to capture it, you know, hard to go around and get them all later. I would really like, actually, it would be really nice if somewhere in iOS you could go into like the About section, and you could say tap on the MAC address, and it would just show a barcode on the screen that you could scan. That would be really nice.
Yeah. Sounds like a bug report you should file.
That does sound like a feature we should have.
So really, and then after that, I basically, you know, plug in their Time Machine drive, tell it to basically inherit the old backup history, and making sure that kind of will start a backup. I stop it.
That works really well now, doesn't it?
It does. It really works well. And we're keeping the same backup drives. You know, obviously they're 3 years old, so ideally we would just replace them. But again, that's a lot of money. And, you know, I actually had one teacher that I could tell her backup drive was kind of getting, you know, where it wasn't working as well. And so I actually ordered her a new one. And so if one needs to be replaced, I'll replace it. But I'm also much more confident in these computers because of the type of hard drive that's in them. So again, we want to have good backups, but I don't want to spend, you know, a couple $1,000 buying new Time Machine drives just if I don't have to. I'll replace them when I can tell they need to be replacing.
Yeah.
So then to give the computer back to the teacher, and we're off. So things I didn't mention were, what am I doing with scrolling, document saving, and then really the 10.8 features that are new. So I'm really not telling them anything. I'm just really letting them figure it out on their own. And I know that seems kind of crazy, but one teacher mentioned the scrolling to me later. She said, "Hey, the scrolling is reverse." And then I said, "Yeah." I said, "That's a new feature in this version of the Mac." And she said, "Yeah, it took me a few months to figure that out." She said, "Why don't they do that?" And I said, "Well, pull out your iPhone and try it." She goes, no, my iPhone is normal. And I said, "Just pull it out and try it." And then she pulled up Pinterest and realized that it's reverse on the iPhone as well. And then, so it really made sense to her there. And so I wanted the teachers to kind of more of an experiment to see what would they do if I didn't tell them. One teacher figured out how to change it. It was actually our PE teacher. He didn't like it, so he figured out how to change it. And the rest of them have just really adjusted. So on the document.
Yeah, it's incredibly interesting to me just how easily that's been adopted by most people. I mean, there was, of course, a big internet drama about it in the first week, but, you know, once that was over, most people, and almost everybody I know has got it on the new line, the post-line setting, so-called natural scrolling, I believe.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that if you use it for 3 or 4 days, you just get used to it. And again, one of the reasons I didn't want to mention to our teachers that you can reverse it is because I don't know if that'll be a feature in 10.9 or 10.10 or 10.11. That could easily, that the option to change it could easily go away. So the next thing I didn't, you know, basically that's new is the document saving. So that, where there's nearly no save as, there's a duplicate. And since we're not really heavily invested into iWork, you know, we really haven't run into that a whole lot since we're still basically primarily on the desktop and Office school. You know, Office hasn't adopted that. And I think if they did, a lot of businesses would cry. But because it is quite different. Again, of course, then one of the things that also is really new to these computers is iCloud. And I did mention that to our teachers that, hey, if you've got an Apple ID or an iCloud account already set up on your phone or your iPad, you are more than welcome to sign in. And, you know, kind of mentioned about messages and things like that. Again, that's something that's kind of a tough thing because you know, if you implicitly say, hey, do this, and then something breaks, it is kind of that awkward, well, I can't really put in a ticket for you with Apple because it's your account, but we certainly don't want to, like, you know, just persuade them not to do it. Because, again, like, teachers text message me a lot through the day over iMessage, say, hey, I have an issue with this, or can you help me with that? And if they can do that with their computer, then that's great.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the downside of working at our scale is that you're going to be helping those people with their problems regardless of whether you've really supported it or not, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You're going to be their guy regardless.
Well,
whereas if you're in a university environment where you've got 15,000 people that you're dealing with, then, you know, okay, maybe you have to be a lot more strict about what you can help with and what you can't. But in a small situation like the one we work in, the upside is flexibility. The upside is not needing to have all these systems in place. But the downside, of course, is that regardless of whether or not you've committed to helping with the problem, you're going to end up be helping with the problem.
Yeah, I get calls from teachers on the weekends, like they're out, you know, at the local Mac reseller wanting to buy a new computer for the house, and they're asking me what they should buy. You know, is that my job? No, but it takes me 10 minutes, and that's fine. You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because I got an email on Sunday from one of our church members. And again, I mentioned that I do side work for our church as well. And it was as a church member said, he couldn't get connected to the Wi-Fi. It would connect to the guest network, but it would never let him browse. I knew the wireless was working because I logged into Hive Manager with Aerohive, and I had 300 or 400 people connected. It was, you know, during Sunday morning. And so I said, hey, you know, I don't really know what's going on, but why don't you come by on Monday? So this was Sunday. I actually had to go into work yesterday to fix a little cabling issue. So I said, hey, just come by about 10:30 and I'll take a look at it. He brought me his laptop. It was a netbook, oddly enough. And I looked, and his DNS settings were like custom set. So they weren't set to get DNS from the DHCP server. And it's funny because they were the same DNS settings one of our staff members was when he came back from a mission trip in Egypt. It was like some 4.2.1.1. So I don't know if like there was some like connecting at a hotel or some sort of coffee shop.
Egyptian government DNS server.
Yeah, it must be. And so it was still using those. Well, I've got, again, I apply our second layer of filtering through OpenDNS, which obviously means you must be using their DNS servers. So in Aerohive's firewall settings, I have a policy built that if someone is using the DNS servers other than the ones I provide, which I input those, then to deny access. So that's why he was getting denied access, because his DNS servers were custom set, and that's obviously something I've enabled to deny him access. So I quickly changed it back and fixed it. You know, again, it goes back to, is that ultimately my responsibility? You know, it's debatable. I mean, he is a church member, but is that, you know, is my job to support a church member's computer? Again, that's very debatable. But it took me 5 minutes, and it goes back to, why would you not just help somebody that takes 5 minutes?
That's it.
So then it turns out he's actually married to the mother of a good friend of mine. So I didn't know that either. Found that out later. So that's really kind of all the big changes from the old laptops to the new. Again, a lot of it, we just let teachers figure out on their own. I want them to be learners. I want them to be able to tinker, and to, if they want to know about Notification Center, they can come ask me, or they can Google it. And the teachers that we've had, some of our teachers have been on their new laptops for about 2 weeks now, and they all are, you know, loving it. One of the things that they really like is now it has a camera slot, or an SD card slot, and our old computers did not have that.
Yeah. I guess when you're moving from Snow Leopard to Mountain Lion, the experience is, for a lot of teachers, particularly when you said most of them are carrying iOS devices, it's going to be, oh, there's that thing that's on my iPhone already. You know, and there's going to be a level of familiarity there, but not necessarily from the old version of macOS as much as from their more recent experience on iOS.
You're exactly right. You know, the halo effect of people having iPhones and iPads personally is that they require less training professionally, because they're doing that stuff at home. Like they understand that Safari is the web browser. They're familiar with messages. And actually, completely off topic, what app are you using for podcasting now on your iPhone?
I have been using Instacast 3 for a while. And I'm since Apple did the update, the 1.2 update to podcasts, I've been trying that as well. So I'm kind of sitting with all my podcasts in both applications at the moment.
I just yesterday switched to Apple's podcast app, and I'm pretty impressed with this update.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I like the old podcast app. The main reason I didn't use it was because the syncing wasn't very reliable. But also, I mean, the syncing doesn't seem to be reliable in any podcast app. All of them seem to have their issues. And it seems to me that the longer you leave between using one version and using the other version, between two different devices, the worse the sync becomes. Particularly if you download and listen to and finish and delete an episode on one device, and then the other device doesn't know that you've read it on the other one. So I'm looking for something that really has a bulletproof syncing system.
Yeah, I've had some pretty good experiences so far with Apple's app with the syncing. But again, I've only been using it for a day, and you know my workflow on podcasts is going to be 90% on the iPhone and then 10% on the iPad. So if the syncing is, you know, is flaky, that's going to be frustrating. But I was using Downcast and I really love Downcast, but you know this new update from Apple is pretty nice. And the only downside about Apple's app, like, you know, in our show notes in Instacast or Downcast, the link, there's actually live links, but there's not in Apple's app.
Yeah, I saw some people complaining about that on Twitter, but that could be 1.3.
Yeah, we'll see. But it's interesting to see how Apple's software design is going, and I'm wondering if that's a taste of things to come in iOS 7.
It could well be. It could be. I mean, I think I don't believe that everything that looks like something should be removed from iOS. I mean, I've seen some mock-ups of people have done where basically everything's had that kind of light gray texture on it, like the new music app has got in iOS 6. And one of my problems with that is that you don't really get a sense of being grounded in whatever app you're in. You can end up just saying every app looks like every other app, but because if you think about it, there's so kind of minimal amount of Chrome on iOS apps. There's the tab bar at the bottom if you've got that, and the toolbar at the top. And if they all just look like two silver strips, then I think it's going to feel a bit flat. I think, you know, I'm not against the design cues in iOS 6. There's deeper problems in iOS than just the design.
Yeah, I would rather them fix some other issues than, you know, design can be last. But that's completely off topic. I was just looking at my phone, and I meant to ask you about that. Yeah. So getting close to an hour here, so we'll run through the rest of this. So our teachers now, again, have a pretty good old computer still. And so our headmaster decided, said, hey, this is something small. We can sell these, obviously, but we decided to let all the teachers keep their old computers. And so that's kind of, they can give that to their husband. They can sell it if they want to. They can do with it what they'd like. So I reminded our teachers about MagSafe and MagSafe 2 and said, hey, you know, I know a lot of you will probably want to leave your new power cords here at work and use your old ones at home with your new computer. If you want to do that, then you'll need to purchase this $10 adapter. So I included an Amazon link. But then I also said, hey, if you want to actually purchase a second adapter, here's a link for that as well. That's not something we provide, so they'd actually have to pay for that themselves. But we have a lot of teachers do that, and I have done that. I would rather spend $80, you know, one time over 3 years than have to carry back a power cord every day.
Yeah, definitely. I've always been a fan of having two cords. I actually use the Apple 24-inch cinema display at work, which has got a MagSafe cord on the display, which is pretty useful. I had to buy a MagSafe adapter for that, but I just leave it permanently connected to the screen and it's fine.
So our again, after the school year's out, we'll have 20 student computers that we will be selling. And so what I'm doing there is I've created a Google form, and so we're selling them for, I believe, $350. And so I sent an email to all of our faculty and said, hey, if you'd like to purchase one of these to have for your student or for your kids or just an extra one at home, here's the link to sign up for that. And most of those have actually already been sold. And the ones that don't sell, I'm actually going to sell to Gazelle, which is a kind of buy and resell service for Apple products. I'm going to sell to them in bulk.
Yeah, I've seen some other people do that as well. And it's a reasonable way to get some value back from your lease.
Well, what I'm going to do is there's some small network upgrades I want to make this summer, and so I'm kind of using that money to pay for that. So it's kind of like, you know, selling one thing to pay for another.
That's what we do.
So, you know, we'll talk about the student computers later because that's in a show we talk about our summer plans, but it's a similar process. Again, it's very simple. I'm not using a big fancy imaging server. You know, again, I'm not doing, you know, 300 machines. I'm doing, you know, 30 to 50 total.
Yeah.
So that's really, that's our process. It's worked well so far. I'm about halfway done, and our teachers are loving their computers. They're loving how light they are. I find it really interesting that all of our teachers put cases on their computers, and that really is interesting to me.
Do you mean like a sort of spec style clip-on case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they will go to Amazon, or they will go to our local Mac resale and they pick one up immediately. And I don't know if it's about like colorizing it or just trying to protect it. And a lot of our teachers are really big on the keyboard covers, which I cannot stand those. But again, if it keeps food out of my keyboards, I guess I'm okay with that.
I've never used either of those products. So I know people have got them, of course, but I understand that there are customized AeroHive ones that one can get. I have not been the recipient of such things, but I have seen them floating around.
Ah, I have not seen those either.
No. Yeah. We'll see if they turn up in the mail at some point.
Maybe so, maybe so. If you've got any questions about this workflow or anything like that, feel free, obviously, to email me or shoot me an @reply on Twitter. Again, it's worked well for us. It's simple, and it just kind of works.
Sounds like a great plan. It's something I'm not going to touch our Macs this summer, but obviously we've got our iPad redeployment coming up, so that's going to be that'll be fertile material for a few podcasts as well, I'm sure.
We've both got busy summers ahead of us, especially me, because we are moving, and then we are having a new baby, and then I have a lot of new gear to deploy.
Well, see, I scheduled the baby at the right time.
Yeah,
my friend.
I need to talk to my wife about that.
Yes, everything can be scheduled. That's how we work. All right, well, good show. I guess we'll wrap up for now. The website for the podcast, outofschool.net, you can leave us feedback there. Feedback in iTunes is also really appreciated if you can leave us a review or a star rating in there. You can get in touch with me on Twitter at Fraser Spears. Bradley, where can people find you online?
At Bradley Chambers on Twitter and app.net.
Okay. And I'll speak to you all next time.
Bye, everybody.